Dr. Glenn Coulthard recently visited Halifax, located in unceded Mi'kmaq territory, on January 12th and 13th, 2012. Coulthard is a member of the Yellowknives Dene and a scholar of contemporary Indigenous politics and political thought. He is an assistant professor in First Nations Studies at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Coast Salish Territory. He is a founding member of the Camas Books and Info Shop in Victoria and the Dachinta Center for Research and Learning in Yellowknives Dene Territory, as well as being a member of the Frank Paul Society. Coulthard has also participated in the Purple Thistle Institute. The first of two talks he gave during his visit is called Place Against Empire: Primitive Accumulation, Settler Colonialism, and the Occupy Movement. Coulthard emphasizes the need to understand the theft of Indigenous lands through Canadian history and its ramifications for present-day politics. He argues that Indigenous radicalism is rooted in a relationship to land and place that runs counter to prevailing Canadian capitalist ideologies of private property and resource exploitation. And he posits that a failure of the Occupy movement in North America is not recognizing the privilege of the 99% over the theft of land and resources from the Indigenous 4%.
Even the ever-increasingly downtrodden 99% are nonetheless settler beneficiaries of the ongoing dispossession and occupation of the roughly 4% of Indigenous peoples who have managed to survive the genocidal effects of settlement, capitalist development, and state formation on their territories.
Without further ado, Dr. Glenn Coulthard.
So today, I changed the title of my talk. It's now called Place Against Empire, Primitive Accumulation, Settler Colonialism, and the Occupy Movement. So I'm going to speak to you today for about 20 minutes on kind of things that I've been thinking about in terms of left, settler, and Indigenous solidarity. But I'm going to speak to you about it through what I've thought about the Marxist tradition and Marx's work. Specifically. So before I entered into or started going to school after high school, I was always struck on the West Coast, this is in BC, where there's a strong left presence in Vancouver, about a general disregard for issues pertaining to settler colonialism and Indigenous resistance. And as I kind of went on with or decided to enter into university, I started to think about this as a kind of, in an academic sense too. So it's born of kind of my relationship with the left as a Native person, and this reading of Marx is kind of reflective of that. So bear with me for the first 20 minutes. And then I'm going to situate it in relation to what I see as some of the colonial baggage that the Occupy movement has been called on and hasn't, to my, in my opinion, navigated as sufficiently as it could have, or it could. So today I want to explore, and this is just in a very provisional way, the critical utility of Marx's notion of primitive accumulation for developing an understanding of the dynamics that shape the colonial relationship between Indigenous peoples and the state, and I'll focus with Canada. I also hope to situate some of the insights drawn from this critical engagement with the work of Marx and Marxism to shed light on the Occupy movement and how it's proven, and its complicated relationship with settler privilege, colonial power, and the ongoing dispossession and continued occupation of Indigenous territories here in Canada. It should just be noted that this very cursory discussion is part of a larger project that I've been working on. And this project, which is turning into a book, basically maps the contours of what has been a very important shift in the way that colonial power operates in Canada post-1969. So in 1969, the federal government issued a policy statement proposal on Indian policy in Canada, called the White Paper, and it facilitated a bunch of resistance because it was basically a call to have indigenous peoples assimilated into the body politic in one fell swoop by legally eliminating the indigenous population as distinguishable from non-native Canadians under the Indian Act. So in the wake of the period of red power activism that followed this proposal, the colonial apparatus that frames indigenous state relations in Canada began to shift, and this is my claim that I look at in the book, from a structure that was primarily reinforced by policies, techniques, and ideologies that more or less explicitly sought the genocidal exclusion and assimilation of indigenous peoples, to one that is now reproduced through a more seemingly friendly language of recognition of our rights and our so-called cultural distinctiveness. So over the course of literally a few years, like 3 years, between 69 and 73 roughly, you see an about-face, or what seems to be an about-face, in how the federal government thinks of Aboriginal peoples and their rights. Prior, there were very few rights that could be called upon, and then you have the inauguration of this idea that we do have rights, they're being recognized, constitutionally protected, and so on. So you have this shift to like genocidal exclusion, assimilation, to now recognition and accommodation. So regardless of the shift, the relationship between indigenous peoples and the state has, of course, remained absolutely colonial to its foundation. And today I want to suggest that an appropriately modified version of Marx's primitive accumulation thesis provides a useful frame to at least to begin to develop a critical understanding of what this relationship entails, what it's about, what its aims are, and what its effects are. So in context of settler colonial domination, as the context which we live in today, I suggest that this modification of Marx demands that we shift our analysis of capitalism from what I refer to as a temporal frame, so a frame which emphasizes too exclusively the injustices associated with the exploitation of labor as the theft of our time, as workers' time, to a spatial frame, which includes an analysis along with the theft or exploitation of labor, which situates or resituates injustice as the theft of land or place. So that's what I refer to as this spatial frame. So to begin, I just want to start with what I mean by colonial relationship, or more importantly, or appropriately in our context, a settler colonial relationship. In such places like Canada, a colonial relationship is one that is defined by or is characterized as a form of domination. That is, it's a relationship where power, in our case, interrelated material and ideological facets of economic, gendered, racial, and state power, has been constructed into a relatively secure set of hierarchical social relations which facilitate and continue to facilitate the ongoing dispossession of Indigenous people's land base and Indigenous people's self-determining capacity and authorities. In Canada, colonial domination continues to be structurally oriented around the state's long-standing commitment to maintain, first through force, fraud, and more recently through so-called negotiations over land and self-government, ongoing access to the land that contradictorily provides the material and spiritual sustenance of our societies on the one hand, and the foundation of colonial state formation, settlement, and capitalist development on the other. And I want to quote an anthropologist here, Patrick Wolfe, whose writings on settler colonial social formations I've learned a lot from. And he says, whatever settlers may say, and they generally have a lot to say, the primary motive of settler colonialism is not race or religion or ethnicity or grade of civilization, etc., but access to territory. Territoriality is settler colonialism's specific, irreducible element. So this is a struggle that is oriented very much around the question of land. Now, in thinking about colonialism as this form of structured dispossession, I have found it useful to return to a cluster of insights that are developed in the work Marx's First Capital, Volume 1, in chapters 26 through 32. These chapters, I believe, are fundamental to, or they have been fundamental to my understandings, because it is here that Marx links the totalizing power of capital or capitalism with that of colonialism by way of his theory of primitive accumulation. Primitive accumulation, for Marx, refers to the host of colonial-like state practices which gave birth to the capitalist mode of production, so capitalism, by forcefully stripping, through what he called conquests and slavery, robbery and murder, non-capitalist producers, communities and societies from their means of production. So stripping non-capitalist peoples from the land, in other words. What this did, according to Marx, this gruesome, violent process, what it did is that through the process of dispossession, ripping people from the land, it over time creates a process of proletarianization. So it establishes the fundamental requirements for capitalism as such, the capital relationship. You strip people of their means of an independent existence, and then they are left with no other choice but to go work for another person in order to sustain themselves over time. So the historical process of primitive accumulation then, according to Marx, refers to this violent transformation of non-capitalist forms of life into capitalist ones. And it's done through these colonial state practices. Now, the usefulness of Marx's notion of primitive accumulation for analyzing the relationship between the logics of colonial rule and capitalist accumulation in the contemporary period has been the subject of much debate over the last couple of decades. Within and between the fields of indigenous studies, with indigenous scholars taking the lead, and Marxist political economy, these debates have at times been hostile and polarizing. At its worst, this hostility has led to the premature rejection of Marxist historical materialist analyses by indigenous studies, including myself at one point, on the one side. And I'm thinking here in particular of Ward Churchill's polemic against Marx and Marxism in the 1980s, following controversies over the Contra struggles in Latin America. And then, of course, there's the belligerent dismissive stance taken toward indigenous struggles for self-determination and colonialism by many often male, white, orthodox Marxists on the other side of the equation. So when these debates are placed alongside and in conversation with others, together they have identified at least three problems, not only three, but I'm going to focus on three, problematic features with Marx's primitive accumulation thesis, which I think must be addressed in order for the relevancy to kind of shine through when we're thinking about indigenous people's struggles against colonialism and capitalism. So I'm just going to go through these now and speak to what I believe to be their relevance. The first feature involves what many have characterized as Marx's rigidly temporal framing of the phenomena of primitive accumulation. As early as 1899, anarchist geographer and a favorite of mine, Peter Kropotkin, made note of what he claimed to be an erroneous division drawn in Marx between, quote, the primary or primitive accumulation of capital and its present-day formulation. So the point that Kropotkin is making here, and many contemporary authors and activists have picked up on it, is that Marx tended to portray primitive accumulation as this inaugural event, located some point in the distant past, but which had come to see itself through to completion in the present. So for Marx, the era of violent colonial dispossession may have inaugurated the era of capitalist accumulation. In the end, it is, quote, and this is Marx speaking, the silent compulsion of economic relations that ultimately sets the seal on the domination of the capitalist over the worker. The problem with this formulation is that history has clearly proven this rigidly temporal understanding to be false. as the recent work of a diverse idea of activists and scholars like David Harvey, Sylvia Federici, Taggy Alfred, Andy Smith have highlighted, the escalating onslaught of violent state-orchestrated enclosures following neoliberalism's ascent to hegemony clearly demonstrates the ongoing nature of violent imperial colonial enclosures on the global scale. So this is a persistent feature of the reproductive function of capitalism. The second feature that needs to be addressed in Marx concerns what I'm calling a normative developmentalism that underscores Marx's original formulation of the thesis. I stress original here because Marx began to reformulate this teleological aspect of his thought in the last decade of his life. And this reformulation has important implications with respect to how we think about and conceptualize the struggle of non-Western societies against colonialism and capitalism. For much of his career, however, Marx developed within his writings a typically 19th century modernist view of history and historical progress or development. This developmentalist ontology provided the overarching frame from which theorists as philosophically diverse as Immanuel Kant, Hegel, John Stuart Mill, and Adam Smith sought to unpack and historically rank various different forms of cultural life in relation to their approximation of the human good. As this modernist commitment often led Marx, along with his buddy Engels, to depict those non-Western societies deemed to be at the lower, less civilized, progressive end of this chain as people without history, existing, and I'll quote Negri and Hart here, quote, separate from the development of capital and locked into an immutable present without the capacity for historical innovation. So we're locked in this kind of primitive state. As a result, Marx's most influential work tends to not only portray primitive accumulation as a historical phenomenon in the way that I talked about it before, is something that's rooted or some inaugural event that has since passed, but also an inevitable and progressive feature of historical development. So it will have a progressive bettering effect on those non-Western societies who are violently dragged into the capitalist circuit. Consider, for instance, Marx's often and perhaps overquoted, but nonetheless significant and important 1953 New York Tribune articles where he's writing on colonial, the nature of British rule in India. There he suggests that although vile and barbaric in practice, colonial dispossession would nonetheless have the, quote, revolutionary effect of bringing the despotic, undignified, stagnant, oriental despotism life of the Indians into the fold of capitalist modernity and thus onto the one true path of human development and emancipation, Western or socialism. Here Marx is highlighting not only the progressive social and cultural, but also the cognitive transformation that labor under capitalist command is supposed to produce in those subject to it. The culturally backward become enlightened, according to this line of reason, through the dreadful process of being churned through the social relations of capitalist labor. And only then do we come to see our real selves as a class in itself, ready to act in our own interests. That is, ready to embark on a struggle, a united struggle, to undermine the conditions that create ourselves as classes. So just as Hegel had infamously asserted before him that Africa existed at the threshold of world history with no movement or development to exhibit, Marx in the future results of the British rule in India would declare Indian society has no history at all, at least no known history. Clearly, any analysis of our critique of contemporary settler colonialism must be stripped of this racist feature of Marx's original historical narrative. But this raises the question, how do we address this residual feature of Marx's early analysis? And this gets to the topic or the subject title of my talk, Place Against Empire. For our purposes here, I suggest that this can most effectively be accomplished by contextually shifting our investigation from an emphasis on the capital relation to the colonial relation. From a temporal emphasis on the theft of time to a spatial emphasis on the theft of place. Marx was primarily, as suggested in his critical appraisal of some dude named Wakefield in Capital, Marx was primarily interested in colonialism because it exposed some truth about the nature of capitalism. His interest in the specific character and effects of colonial domination were largely incidental. This is clearly evident in how he thinks about primitive accumulation. As noted already, primitive accumulation involved two processes for Marx. The first was through violent state dispossession, and the second was resulting in the creation of workers and proletarianization. The weight given to these co-foundational elements in Marx, and by many on the left, though, has remained ambiguous, if not weighted to one side. So the left has tended to focus on the primary injustice of the exploitation of our labor and the inequalities associated with that, while paying less attention to the ongoing dispossession of land that provides the whole historical and empirical context within which the exploitation of labor is dependent and operates itself through. So this co-foundational element gives way to this emphasis on the left, which focuses on the inequalities associated with the exploitation of labor under capitalist relationships. And this is evident in Marx's own writings. So for instance, in chapter 33 of Capital, Marx had little interest, he states that he had little interest in the colonies as such, but what caught his attention was, quote, the secret developed in the New World by the political economy of the Old World, that the capitalist mode of production and accumulation have for their fundamental condition the expropriation of the worker, so the exploitation of labor. So when you examine it through this rather narrow angle, dispossession appears to constitute an appropriate object of critique or concern and analysis only insofar as it unlocks, for Marx, the understanding of the nature of capitalism. That capital isn't a thing, but rather a social relationship dependent on the perpetual separation of workers from their means of production. This was obviously Marx's primary concern, and has subsequently, I would suggest, remained the dominant concern of the Marxist tradition as a whole. The contextual shift advocated by me here today, on the other hand, takes as its analytical frame the subject position of the colonized in relation to the effects of colonial dispossession, the theft of place, rather than from the primary position of the waged, usually male proletariat in the process of commodity production. Now, to my mind, a number of crucial insights into our colonial present emerge from this shift. For example, by shifting our perspective from the capital relationship, so the wage relation, to the colonial relationship, so the dispossession relation, the injustice of domination resulting from colonial dispossession is posited on its own terms and its own right. It is not a harm just because it produces workers. It is a harm that has its effects independent of that. The repositioning of the colonial frame as our overarching lens of analysis, it becomes clear and far more difficult to justify in antiquated developmental terms from either the right wing or the left wing, the assimilation of non-capitalist, non-Western, indigenous modes of life with the assumption that this assimilation will somehow magically enlighten us in our kind of violent absorption into modernity. And in a certain respect, this is what also was the guiding insight behind Kropotkin's concern with Marx as well. But I'll get to that in a sec. That eventually led Marx to reformulate this understanding of historical development within his own work. Subsequently, in the last decade of his life, non-Western and non-capitalist social relations are no longer condemned by Marx to necessarily pass through the destructive phase of capitalism in order to be churned out enlightened proletarians on the other side, or socialists. During this period, Marx had not only come to view more clearly how certain features of non-capitalist and capitalist modes of production can articulate, so work together in a given social formation, but he also began to see the ways in which aspects of the former, so non-capitalist social relations and forms of life, can come to inform the construction of radical alternatives to the latter, capitalism. And it's this insight that informed Kropotkin's critique of Marx as well. The problem for Kropotkin was that Marx not only drew that erroneous division between the history of state dispossession and what's clearly proven to be its enduring and lasting character into the present, but that it also seemed to justify, in Marx, the violent dispossession of place-based, non-state modes of self-sufficient indigenous activity, only this time, to be carried out under the centralized authority of socialist state, what eventually Soviet economists would eventually refer to as socialist accumulation. So for Kropotkin, the ongoing violence of dispossession constitutes a defining feature of state power as such, regardless of any given state's particular economic orientation. I suggest that by shifting our analytical frame to the colonial relation, we might occupy a better angle from which to both anticipate and interrogate practices of dispossession justified under otherwise egalitarian principles and espoused with so-called progressive state political agendas in mind. Instead, what must be recognized by those inclined to advocate a blanket return of the commons as a redistributive counter-strategy to the neoliberal state's round of enclosures is that in liberal settler states like Canada, the commons actually belong to somebody, the first peoples of these lands. But they also deeply inform and sustain indigenous modes of thought and behavior that harbor profound insights into a more sustainable world order. By ignoring or downplaying the central aspect of dispossession, the left not only risks becoming complicit in the very structures of domination and processes of domination that they ought to oppose, but they risk overlooking what could prove to be invaluable glimpses in indigenous forms of life and activism that could teach us about the ethical, place-based, land-based practices and preconditions required for freedom. Another insight facilitated by this contextual shift from time to place has to do with the role played by Indigenous labor in Canada, in particular the historical formation of the Canadian state and political economy. It's now generally acknowledged by historians and political economists that following the waves of successive colonial settlement that marked the transition between mercantile and industrial capitalism in Canada, native labor became more superfluous in relation to the political and economic development of the state. Increased European settlement combined with an imported, hyper-exploited non-European workforce meant that in the post-fur trade period, Canadian state formation and colonial capitalist development required first and foremost land, and only secondarily the surplus value afforded by cheap indigenous labor. This isn't to suggest, of course, that the long-term goal of indoctrinating our indigenous subjects, our communities, to the principles of private property, possessive individualism, and menial wage labor did not constitute an important and fundamental feature of the colonial project, because it did. What I want to point out, rather, is that when related back to primitive accumulation, it appears that the history and experience of dispossession, not proletarianization, has been the dominant background structure shaping the character of the relationship between our communities and the Canadian state. Not only this, but I would also argue that dispossession also continues to inform the dominant modes of indigenous resistance and critique that this relationship has produced. Stated bluntly, the theory and practice of indigenous anti-colonialism, including contemporary expressions of indigenous anti-capitalism, is best understood as a struggle primarily inspired by and oriented around the question of land. A struggle not only for land in the material sense of that which is under our feet, but also deeply informed by the land as a system of reciprocal relationships and obligations that can teach us about how to live our lives in relation to one another and the natural world in non-dominating and non-exploitative terms. And it is far less about our status as what Marx liked to call rightless proletarians. Now, with these insights noted, I can turn to the third and final feature of Marx's thesis that I think needs to be addressed, and then I'll conclude with relating this to the Occupy question. This one brings us back to my original claim at the outset that in Canada, colonial relations of power are no longer reproduced primarily through overtly coercive or imposed means, but rather through the asymmetrical exchange of mediated forms of recognition in the forms of rights to land, recognition of rights to self-government, recognition of right to participate in economic development, and so on. This is quite different, I think, than the original story that Marx tells, where the driving force behind dispossession and accumulation is still overwhelmingly that of state, explicit state sovereign violence. It is a relationship of brute force, of servitude, whose methods, Marx claims, are anything but idyllic. The strategic deployment of violence, sovereign power, serves the primary reproductive function of the colonial accumulation process in Marx's writings on colonialism and imperialism. As Marx himself bluntly put it, these gruesome state practices are what thrust capitalism onto the world stage, quote, dripping from head to toe, from every pore in blood and dirt. The question that needs to be asked for us, however, is what if explicit acts of state orchestrated violence no longer constitute the norm, the center stage, underwriting and facilitating the reproduction of the colonial process as it does in Capital, in those passages in Capital? As it supposedly does in multinational, or doesn't anymore, in liberal, tolerant, multinational settler polities such as Canada. So if we reframe it in Marx's own terms, if neither blood and fire nor the silent compulsion of capitalist economic relations can adequately account for the reproduction of colonial hierarchies in places like Canada, what can? And in my other work, I go and I look at how this is reproduced through the language and the scripting of terms of recognition that are entirely focused still around gaining access to lands and resources. So you look at the recognition of land claims or an indigenous right to land in Canada, for example. The state recognizes, like the state originally recognized Indians, only to create a category that it can then focus on legally extinguishing. So indigenous rights to lands are recognized by the state in order to extinguish them. And the reason that they're extinguished is in order to clear the legal means necessary to create certainty to facilitate the types of development that the state requires of those lands. So you have a context like British Columbia, for example, where you had the looming question, because there were no historical treaties signed there, of who owns this land and who has jurisdiction over it. Native people rightfully claiming that they do, the state obviously claiming that it does. Native people were pissed off by the non-recognition of their rights in that territory, so they established for more than two decades, blocking flows of constituted capital and state power in and out of those communities through direct action, roadblocks. That created the context of economic uncertainty, and the economy of the resource economy of British Columbia took a hit. It was only when it took a hit that British Columbia agreed that maybe not recognizing Indigenous people's rights to land in this context isn't our wisest venture. In order to ensure access to those resources, to gain legal certainty over who owns what and what the development plans over those resources are, we'll enter into the land claim process. So land claim process recognizes an indigenous right to land in order to get rid of it to pave the way for settlement and development. So this is how recognition, this is the kind of the gift that recognition has given us, is that it still facilitates this ongoing process of accumulation in relation to capitalist development and settlement. So to conclude, I want to return to my opening promise and try and tie together what all of this Marx stuff means in relation to the state of the Occupy movement and its relationship to settler privilege, colonial power, and the ongoing dispossession and occupation of indigenous people's homelands. Since its inception, and no one's going to be ignorant of this, indigenous peoples and their allies have challenged very convincingly, to my mind, the Occupy movement to situate as central to its praxis an anti-colonial analysis, an anti-settler colonial analysis. These diverse critiques have challenged the movement for its hegemonization of white democracy and its reification of settler colonial normativity, so just a naturalization of the settler colonial condition in Canada and in the US. This has contributed to a general failure on the part of the movement, and you see this in general assemblies in Vancouver, to the ones in Oakland, to the ones in New York, to recognize that in places like Canada and the United States, but I'm speaking particularly here about Canada, that even the ever increasingly downtrodden 99% are nonetheless settler beneficiaries of the ongoing dispossession and occupation of the roughly 4% of indigenous peoples who have managed to survive the genocidal effects of settlement, capitalist development, and state formation on their territories. So I would suggest that this lack of radical imagination on the part of certain segments on the left and in the Occupy movement shares many similarities of the left's and Marxist left's in general failure to recognize the centrality of ongoing colonial dispossession in the reproduction of capitalist or settler colonial relationships and therefore capitalist social relations in places like Canada and the United States. Now, Marx himself, I think, even came around to this late in his life, and this came around in an engagement that he had with critics of his from Russia. So they came from the Russian populist movements, and one of them was Vera Sizulik, who was this anarchist populist supporter in Russia at the time. And what she says, she says to Marx, she's like, I'm looking at some peasant commune friends of mine, and radicals in the Russian scene, seem to read your work as suggesting that instead of hunker down and defend and build capital or non-capitalist alternatives to colonial capitalist development in Russia based on the traditions of the Russian commune, you seem to be suggesting that we ought to just absorb ourselves within the relationships of capitalist command and be churned out the side, proletarians, and then on the road to socialism. And Marx at that point says, well, actually I'm not suggesting that. He was suggesting that when earlier in life, but then he starts to rethink this. And he's like, if you want to talk to your populist friends, I think these are the conditions that would require the Russian commune, which at this point is on the periphery of the West, to proliferate and actually provide a non-Western alternative to capitalist development. And he gave a number of caveats in order to, which he thought would require these communes to provide alternatives to capitalist colonial sort of expansion. And those caveats were, one, that the communal social relations and forms that were being built up in the commune be civic national, not ethnic national. So they had to be national in scope and not associated with communal relationships based on kinship. So they couldn't be familial, they had to be national. His second caveat was that the Russian populace involved in the commune had to be able to seize the gifts of capitalist modernity in terms of technology without enslaving themselves to it. So you couldn't be nativist or anti-development in those sorts of sense. You had to be able to seize the gadgets of capitalism without enslaving yourself to it. And then finally, his most important caveat was that these communal forms, the Russian populace and their supporters, would necessarily have to be able to link and ally their struggles with the urban proletariat. So struggles of workers in the cities. So those three caveats, and then he's like, if those three caveats or if those three conditions are in existence and can be shown to proliferate, then they can be shown to provide an alternative to just kind of assimilating oneself into the workforce as rightless proletarians. So they can be the building blocks, in Marx's terms, of an alternative to capitalism. Now, what I want to suggest in the context of the Occupy movement is the opposite, is that the kinship social relations and ethical practices that are involved in land-based struggles, whether they're at the ones that are oriented around Caledonia, the ones that are emerging around Enbridge pipeline in British Columbia, the ones that are oriented around and blocking access to roads in the Northwest Territories that are showing concern and proliferating in relation to the tar sands that have been in existence for almost a decade outside of Kenora at Grassy Narrows. Are those the social relations that are grounding and informing those place-based practices of indigenous reoccupations, or now the language is less occupation, but reclamations, have to be center stage in our struggles and in the Occupy's imaginary. So the burden of proof or the condition for the existence of creating alternatives shouldn't be that of those communities, those indigenous place-based reclamation movements linking up and seeking allies in the urban setting, but the opposite. If there's going to be any shedding of its colonial heritage and its settler privilege, and it's reproducing in subtle and uninformed ways settler colonialism on this continent, the Occupy movement has to ally itself with the primary foundational reclamation movements of indigenous struggles here in Canada. That's its only hope of legitimizing itself as an actual transformative force on this continent. And I think I'll just leave it at that. So, Masicho.
You've been listening to a talk by Dr. Glenn Coulthard called Place Against Empire, Primitive Accumulation, Settler Colonialism, and the Occupy Movement. Recorded in Halifax on unceded Mi'kmaq territory on January 12, 2012. Produced by Praxis Media Productions and the Halifax Media Co-op. Thanks for listening.